Well, my watch says it's 3:10, so let's go ahead and begin. Let's start with prayer. Father, I thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you for the opportunity that we have to trust in you for everything that we learn, everything that we do, and everything that you want us to carry back to our classrooms and schools. I ask for wisdom as I speak and insight for those that listen, that we can understand what you wish to teach us today. In Jesus' name, amen. My name is Catherine Schultz. I am the Associate Headmaster at Schaefer Academy, and I teach 11th grade British literature there. I've been teaching in Christian schools for a little over 20 years and have been at Schaefer for six. So this is a long journey for me. I got into Christian education until I could find a real job and discovered that I love it. So I went on and earned my master's and my doctorate in Christian education leadership and did my research in the area of biblical worldview. So I very much enjoy thinking about literature worldviewishly and getting my students to get captured by the stories and the viewpoints that literature can tell. This presentation is entitled, What Oft Was Thought? Little trivia question, can anyone other than those who already confirmed it with me in the front row identify the speaker of these words? Well, it'll come soon. Alexander Pope said, true wit is nature to advantage dressed, what oft was thought, but never so well expressed. It's from his essay on criticism. And I think it's a starting point for where we can get students thinking about literature. They use the language that they learn to study, hear, appreciate what's beautiful, but they realize that, as Doug Wilson said, I think it was at the Administrator Conference, they're really only seven stories in this world. So as Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun, but there is a wealth of resources from which we can learn and re-express in a beautiful way. We can be creative in that way. So I want to look at this in three categories. I want to look at story, drama, and poetry. And I think that's useful to look at examples of each. Now, if you are a note taker, the notes for this session are on page 112. There's also a handout that I'll refer to because I think my fine print here is too much for even my 47-year-old eyes. So the example works I'm going to look at are Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, Hamlet by Shakespeare, and God's Grandeur by Gerard Manley Hopkins. If you have that notes page open by now, I think you'll find it easiest to take notes if you create a chart that looks like this. Starting with grammar, logic, and rhetoric down the left, create yourself a column for each of the titles that we'll look at, Frankenstein, Hamlet, and God's Grandeur. These are just model works that I've selected as a way of expressing how I would go about teaching literature in the logic and rhetoric classroom. What you'll see takes us all the way to the rhetoric level. When I've taught middle school classes at that logic level, I would stop below that level, but always hint that there's more coming. I think it's a valuable thing for our students to realize that they're never finished learning. So always tantalize them that there is more coming. So you got that figured out? Grammar, logic, and rhetoric should already be on the left side there. Frankenstein, Hamlet, and God's Grandeur across the top. So first, let's look at Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. We're looking then at how do we go about dealing with the grammar of it. Well, there are lots of things about grammar that you could study when you read a story, but the first is the story itself. What is the story? What is the plot line of that story? So if a student doesn't understand what happened, I have to start there. And sometimes, for some students, that's as far as we'll get. But they can love the story itself without getting anything more than that. And their richness still exists in their life. I've still invested in something meaningful in their lives. That also includes knowing the characters, knowing what the character is like, helping them understand how to grasp what an author chose to tell you about a character. By the way the character looks, you can't judge a person by the way they look. You can judge a character by the way they look. All right? Especially if you're thinking about Frankenstein. The fact that the creature is really scary looking matters in the story. It's not an accident, and it's not in any way prejudicial. What the characters say is an indication of what those characters are like, helping the students discover what a character is like through that character's words. What other characters say about that character, and of course, what the narrator says as well. I also work with my students because I want everything that we study in literature to be a tool for learning. I'm very Searsian in that respect. What is it that they can learn about this story that will transfer to others? Well, I do that through a lot of literary terminology. So, a couple of examples. I want my students to know what a novel is, and specifically what a Gothic novel is. We go through those definitions. How does this novel qualify? How is it deviant from that definition in any way? Through the idea of framing, or the term foil. What is a foil? Now, I'm assuming that you have some familiarity with those things, but I'll make sure that you also have this little footnote from me, that JMG, who's JMG? Thank you, John Milton Gregory. The third law does remind us that we need to have a common language with our students, and so one of the ways I do that is through the terminology that I'm constantly using and reinforcing with them in the classroom. So that first spot is dealing with those ideas of storyline, plot, characters, themes. Now, when we look at how to deal with a novel at the logic level, we've got that grammar in place. We know what happened. We know who the characters are that are involved. We've got some language to talk about it. I'm going to pick one example with the term framing. Framing is that literary device where an author tells a story within a story, sometimes a story within a story within a story. So you've got a physical frame. Well, think about the historical context for this. First of all, an author makes a decision about whether they tell a story in a third-person narrator's voice or some other means. Well, Shelley didn't use that, but she did tell the story in the context with her own introduction of, I was trying to, you know, write a story to amuse and scare my friends. So she's working in that context. She created a first narrator, Robert Walton, who's a captain of a ship, to tell the story through the medium of writing letters to his sister. Robert Walton meets Dr. Frankenstein through unusual circumstances, and then basically at the end of his fourth letter says, look, it'll be easier if I just let him tell this in his own words. So the story narrator is handed off and remains in first person, but is now in the character of Victor Frankenstein. Later on in the story, the creature, who never gets a name, if you haven't read it, he never gets a name, he's always just the creature, gets to take over the telling of his story when no one else was present. So I talk to my students about those various things. Now, Walton says, I'm writing these letters and doing this journey to this unusual place because I'm seeking knowledge. I just really need this, and I'm so desperate for a friend in the midst of all this. I just really want to get those things out in public, because that's what I'm working on. Victor Frankenstein says, I'm writing this to warn you, Robert Walton. Your pursuit of knowledge may be really dangerous for you. And then the creature is just desperate to get his story out because he's so lonely. He wants a companion. He wants people to accept him. So as I work through helping the students understand the example of the framing, keep those things in mind. But one of the things we can do then is discuss the impact of filtering the story through those multiple first-person narrator characters. And it has a powerful impact as they come to realize, oh, all of those characters are seeking a place to belong, seeking acceptance, and all the way back up to even the author writing the story for her friends. So you get this repetition of a theme even at these different levels, and they can begin to understand, now I see why this device of framing is a useful tool for an author and can then apply that to other circumstances where they see it. So when we read, for example, Hamlet, which I'll talk about a little later, the play within a play is not just entertainment for the characters, but a device which we who've read a million stories understand furthers the main story rather than being just a deviation. Okay, so then how do we do rhetoric with something like Frankenstein? Is there anyone here who's from Providence in Spring? Okay, the author of this book, if I've read the biography correctly, used to be the humanities chair at the ACCS school in Spring, Texas. His name is Jeff Baldwin, and the book is called The Deadliest Monster. And I stumbled across it along the way somewhere long before I got assigned to teach Frankenstein, but it is an exploration of the idea of the nature of man through two monster stories, Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And his basic premise is Frankenstein concludes that the problem is society. The creature was created pure, clean, and innocent, and it was the rejection of society that corrupted him. It was only in response to society that he turned to the dark side. Whereas Jekyll and Hyde, because Jekyll and Hyde are indeed the same person, is a recognition that the evil, that tendency toward sin, comes not from external forces, but from within us. It is already there. We bring it with us. So we can have conversations like, what is the nature of man? And we can ask questions like, does man have a sin nature? Does this author think that man has a sin nature? Or is man more of a tabula rasa, a blank slate? And he's good to begin with. We can ask questions like, what's the role of society? Is society supposed to be redemptive or corruptive? Is it corrective? Is it punitive? Is it some combination of those things? What worldview-ish kinds of conversations do we have? And our students read Jekyll and Hyde in sixth grade, so that most of them have read it. So then I just need to do a refresher of it when we get to 11th grade before we do Frankenstein. And you know, Jekyll and Hyde is a quick read for an 11th grader who's got some speed skills in place. So it gives me an opportunity to really work through with them, how did this author portray his or her convictions and beliefs about some important issue? So we've talked about novel, story. Let's talk a little about drama, and we'll use Hamlet for that example. Yes, I'm one of those kinds of English teachers. So much so that you have to grasp this. When I was in middle school, I announced to my mother, this summer, I'm going to read the entire Bible, I wasn't even saved at the time, and all of Shakespeare's plays. I have, at this point, now read the entire Bible several times. There are still several Shakespeare plays I have not read, so at least I got my priorities right that way. But I do actually have quite a fondness for Shakespeare, and Hamlet is probably near the top, but please don't ask me what my favorite Shakespeare play is, because I have to subcategorize that before I can answer your question. I know, there's only 37 of them, depending on how you count. But there's so many good ones. Okay, so let's look at the drama and how we teach just the grammar of drama. It's going to look a lot like story because it has the same elements to it. It's still going to deal with plot and characters. It's still going to deal with storyline, that kind of thing. It's still going to have terms, and its special terminology includes things like tragedy or blank verse or soliloquy, and we'll talk a little bit more about what I do with soliloquies later. But it also has famous quotations. So I thought I'd give you a little test and see how your cultural literacy is for Hamlet. This has got to be a room full of English teachers. Nobody else would be here on a Friday afternoon when Doug Wilson is also speaking. So, to be, very good, or not to be, yes, that is the question. Yes, how many of us could go on for another 34 lines, right? Something is rotten in the state of Denmark, very good, and this above all, to thine own self be true. Yes, we do have some of these things just in our blood. I try, this is a little footnote bonus for showing up today, I try to let those things bleed out so that I help the students see this is really in our world. And it was in my head before I had read Hamlet 50 times. So get some of these things in your head. I want you to recognize some of these things. So one of the things that I assess for grammar is just literally a list of, it's about 30 quotations, and I admit a good chunk of those came from my high school lit teacher. But I rejected some of those based on not having encountered them in the world and added a few others based on having encountered them in the world. So I don't think there's one and only one list of the best things to have them learn out of Hamlet. So just pick some. I also, by the way, get their attention with things that have been done to these plays or stories. Y'all know that Dr. Seuss-ish wrote A Green Eggs in Hamlet. Not really. There's ages ago, I clipped out of Reader's Digest a list of combined titles of two different works, and that was Green Eggs and Hamlet, I thought was a good one. So Tom Stoppard, who's a British playwright, 20th century, did indeed write a play called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Very postmodernist, but they can see which are the lines from Hamlet that have bled over into that one. We also have fun with Tom Stoppard wrote another one called The 15-Minute Hamlet. The encore of The 15-Minute Hamlet is The 2-Minute Hamlet. And after they've read The 4.5-Hour Hamlet, they do find The 15-Minute Hamlet exceptionally funny because they get it. Even after one read, they get it. So that's kind of my reward for them. After they've read and done all of this, and we spend almost 10 weeks on Hamlet with all the things that we do with it, they get it. They know it. They actually enjoy it. Now, I admit, some of them are ready to move on by that point. I know. We don't spend 10 weeks on everything. Our literature program uses a combination of depth in a few works, interspersed with bursts of broad exposure to a sampling of works to get a literary time period in their head. So we don't go deep in everything that we do like that. Okay, so how do we deal with logic in Hamlet? Well, I'm going to tackle that by looking at one little excerpt. This is from Polonius's speech early on, "Therefore, since brevity is the soul of wit, and tediousness the limbs and outward flourishes, I will be brief." And then he's not. So I start with the grammar of this. What does it say? Just give me a plain old English translation, 21st century. And it lets them fight through the language and figure out what's the subject, what's the verb, what are the modifiers of those things, what's the before, the after, the if, the then, all of those things. So here's a rough rendering. True intelligence is concise, while useless rhetorical adornments are wasteful and even irritating. Then I'll have them do a little bit of work with it to tackle some aspect that I want them to understand. So in this case, I'm going to use meter as the basis for this example. And I've marked out the unstressed and stressed syllables, and I've divided the feet. Now, you'll see a couple of non-iambic syllables in there. So, for example, we have an extra syllable in the third foot in that line. And in the second line, we have an extra syllable in the second foot. And two extra syllables just tacked on at the end. Now, my little marks at the bottom there indicate that that partial line that I provided is a normal iambic pentameter line. So it's just to show you that it's not there, but I'm not addressing that part. See, we've got extra stuff in here. Extra stuff in a speech by Polonius about being brief takes us to rhetoric. And where do we get with rhetoric? Well, we get a lovely example of dramatic irony with Polonius's words, and through that, support for the theme of words versus action. So when I ask my students to study each of the quotations, they start with just who said it, who they said it to, and where is it placed in the play chronologically. Just have to learn the acts that way. And then they have to explain what it means in standard English and how is it significant, compare it to a theme of the play. So this would be just one example of what they might be able to do there. So now you see taking them through all those levels just as a sample. Third thing. Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote a poem called God's Grandeur. If you haven't fallen in love yet, try Gerard Manley Hopkins. So we'll start again with grammar. And I think one of the things that we need to do in our classes, especially in classical Christian schools, is to help our students understand just plain old who are the big names of the Western tradition. So Gerard Manley Hopkins makes it on that list as far as I'm concerned. Again, we read through the poem. We've got to understand what it says in ordinary English. But then we also want to look at terminology of analyzing and interpreting poetry. So I've given you a couple of examples here. Meter, and specifically for Gerard Manley Hopkins, sprung rhythm. That's a term he invented, an idea he developed. So we want them to grasp that and connect that with him as well, even if they see it in other works later. Then sound devices. I try and give my students mnemonic devices. So echo, alliteration, assonance, consonance, onomatopoeia, those are the sound devices. But then later on, I can just shorthand that and on an exam say, you know, tell me about the sound devices in this example question or in this quotation. So I don't have to list them all each time, trying to categorize things and group them together in ways that are helpful, meaningful, useful to them as they go through acquiring and using these tools effectively. And of course, imagery is a big one for Hopkins. So a little bonus there for you again. John Milton Gregory's first law says that the teacher has to know the material. So you do have to know enough to know who to include in your list of poets. There's plenty of writers out there. You got to pick. You got 170 days. Subtract 10 of them for finals, 10 of them for field trips and other crazy interruptions, 10 of them for unit testing. I have about 130 instructional days in a year. I kind of got that one figured out. I got to pick. And if I'm using 10 weeks of it on Hamlet. Okay. So then we've identified the grammar that we do with a poem. What do we do for logic? You have on your handout a complete text of this poem. I just think it's cruel for me to make you read a font this small on a screen this far away. So you've got it, and you can walk away with it. What do we then do with those terms? This is where I ask the students to apply what they know, not just tell me the definition. So, for example, they might find alliteration and imagery at the end of the second line, like shining from shook foil. Or they might find enjambment from the third to the fourth line. Enjambment is when the sentence wraps around without punctuation ending. So, like the ooze of oil crushed. What a great place to enjam something. And repetition and meter. Generations have trod. And seeing how that just reinforces that iambic meter. Footnote again, when I teach my students meter, they've been exposed to this before, but you know how some things click at different phases? So I try different things. I teach my students to dance. We take a whole class period for it, and only one. I teach them first to march. Now, marching is sometimes beyond the ability of the clumsy, but they can get the concept at least. So marching is nice, good, trochaic meter. Right? This is great. We just get out a little John Philip Sousa. Everybody marches in a circle around the cafeteria. And we can do that. Then I teach them to polka. Because polka is seriously good, I am. Not in its mood, I know. But how can you do better than oompa, 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 oompa to get the idea across? And I teach them to waltz for dactylic meter. And I just tell them, you can remember Anna Pest, that's just because Anna's a pest. So there's no good dance for that one. It doesn't work if you have a student in your class named Anna, which I do about every other year, but we get over it. So that was a little free footnote. So as we look at this, you're seeing the application of the terminology. This is where I'm going to logic. And I'm constantly putting those terms and those ideas in front of my students. You have the definition. You've got the grammar. You've read the poem. We figured out what it said just in plain language. You've got the grammar. Now let's look at the logic. What is it that's here in the structure that you can make connections to those terms that you know about? Okay? And assonance, internal rhyme in the words smeared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. So they get a little flavor of each of those things. I want them to become accustomed to using the vocabulary and identifying the use of these things in a poem. It also gives us an opportunity to ask some of the bigger questions that goes on in sort of literary criticism circles. Did the author put that there on purpose? Did he mean to do that? I don't know. But I can't imagine that one of two things wasn't going on. I can't imagine he didn't do any of it on purpose. And he became really adept at his skill and did that with the skill that was in him, whether or not he tried to do it. But I also have confidence, especially when it's overt like this, but even when it's not, that he was inspired. He was inspired. We can't not breathe that which God puts in our air. So it's a good thing. So then we look at the rhetoric of that terminology, and I ask the students to make a connection between the structure that they've identified and the meaning. So I sort of alluded to it a little earlier. First example, like shining from shook foil. Well, that alliteration around the SH sound really does sound like shaking foil. We get a little bit of auditory imagery. I know that's not quite legal, but it is, really. We can do that. That we then have an opportunity to say that the image that he's trying to create reinforces the sound that he's trying to get you to understand. And they can see, you know, they know what aluminum foil is. They know how to, you know, think about that kind of stuff. Okay, now you see what he was trying to get you to do. I didn't have aluminum foil in the same way, but you get the idea. Or in the example of the ooze of oil crushed, that it oozes around the end of the line, and that it's crushed up against the beginning of that first line. It gives me a chance. I mean, they understand by this time that they get really good at finding caesura because they just look for punctuation. That must be caesura. We start with Beowulf, you know. There's no punctuation there, but after that they can find it. So why would you want the caesura that early in the line? You better stop and allow that word to breathe. And what about the greatness of God, the grandeur of God, is somehow crushed, like oil crushed. And it's great for them to be able to get there. Or in the have trod, they can hear the drudgery of the generations. They really do get that and how the author was able to do that. So one of the things I'm trying to accomplish is to get them to see. And about every other year, God gives me a little gift of a student who will say something like, I find stuff in the literature that I read just for me now that I know what to look for. Or I had it happen this spring for a student who, you know, we all have students that are there because they have to be. And they do what they must, and that's about it. So I didn't see a lot going on here, but the student's parents caught me in the hall at the end of the year and said, our son actually likes to read now. So I think we can open up a world. We have to be careful not to overdo this, because that's easy to just crush them and what they want to see. But there's hope. So if you're looking at a completed version of the chart, you've got an option for the significance of the terms in there as kind of the highest rhetorical level. How is it that the structure of the poem reinforcing the meaning of the poem? I know my shorthand isn't perfect for you, but you've been listening. You can figure that out. Right? So before I move on to the next section here, does anyone have questions you want to ask about how I do grammar, logic, rhetoric with these kinds of literature? Yes. The author of the book, The Deadliest Monster, is J.F. Baldwin. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's look at how students respond to literature. I try to be very practical. But I also know that I've got a limited time, so you know, if this isn't making sense, I'll make sure to answer your question. But I'm trying to be very specific and practical. So the most obvious thing that literature teachers have their students do is write some kind of literary analysis essay. And I think there's a benefit to that, but I also think if I spend a lot of time investing in the literary analysis essay and at the expense of trying to get them to be better crafters of writing, then I'm following in the footsteps of an honorable tradition, but not the one that I think is most honorable. I really want to use what I've learned about classical Christian education even in how they write essays about literature. So I also spend some time having them do imitative writing, even at the high school level. I know a lot of folks do that earlier on, but I keep that on through high school. And I do that with a couple of different projects. I have them write a sonnet in imitation of one of the great Renaissance sonnet writers. I also have them write an ode. And I have them compose a dramatic monologue in imitation of any of the authors that we've read. That's sort of near the end of the year, so they've got a lot to choose from. So I think the essay is a good place for them to develop their skill in logical argument. They need to keep working on that skill even after they had the formal training in logic to see that it applies, that it matters, that it continues to be part of their thinking and intention. But then the imitation is a good skill for practicing their rhetorical skills, style, arrangement, beauty, and to go back to our opening and our title, true wit. They got to develop that somewhere. So, on your handout, you again have a sample from a sonnet by John Milton, When I Consider How My Light Is Spent. And I think probably, even though I could read all of the poem through and then read the student's imitation through, what I'll do is put them up side by side and let you see what she did. I'm sorry, he. I got one of each. What he did as he was writing an imitation. What I told the students was, if you don't know where to start, swipe. Grab the first line or the first part of the first line to get yourself started somewhere. And you can always go back and change it. There's an option to revise these things. But John Milton wrote, when I consider how my light is spent ere half my days in this dark world and wide. Well, Luke Harris wrote, when I consider how the days are spent each as a fleeting vapor passing on. He's tried to imitate the cadence and the meter, the length of line. If you look through, you'll see several other things along the way that he's really kind of catching the structure, the meter, the rhyme along the way. Now, there's an even better example on the next page, if you turn it over. Ode on a Grecian Urn, John Keats. So Keats wrote multiple stanzas. I'm just giving you the first. The student also wrote multiple stanzas, and I'm just giving you the first to give you a flavor here. Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, Sylvan historian, who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme? And Nicole wrote, thou quick and beautiful dance of pleasure, thou ever-moving motion without melody, Terpsichore's gift, how could we measure your fluid grace in player's ecstasy? And in her case, even more alignment with the length of phrasing, the placement of personification, and all of the language that she's chosen. She just really did a spectacular job of finding what in the original was noteworthy and drawing that out as she wrote hers. And you probably could capture how lissome are your lovers as they play and run and jump back and forth, engaging in a tribute to your charm. How abundant are your temples, how full of mirth, how fawning the fans. How dazzling the dancer's form, how sweet the splendor, how divine their way. This is not a dance. You don't get it till the second stanza, but it's a basketball game. The third thing that I'll give you as an example for a project is that I have my students do a dramatic monologue. They select an author to imitate. not necessarily an original, I mean, something that was originally a monologue in what they had, although a few do that. But then they compose a script in the style of that author. Now, I admit, I've seen this done other places, but my main inspiration, is there an Austen fan in the room? Have you seen Emma Thompson's Sense and Sensibility? Have you seen her acceptance speech for the Academy Award, Golden Globe Award, whichever it was? If you have access to a DVD that has her acceptance speech on it, it's a great way to show the students, because they've read Austen, to show the students what is it that is unique about this author's language, vocabulary, expression. Emma Thompson's speech is basically, what would Jane Austen have said about an evening like this? And it captures the humor of Jane Austen so effectively. You just need to go looking, even if you don't like Austen. You need to go looking for the funny moments of what Emma Thompson's acceptance speech for the Sense and Sensibility Award has to say. So I play that for my students, and I ask them to construct this script. And first, it's a written project. What is it about this thing that they've got that imitates that original author? I give them a task to either write the introduction for a famous person. And famous has to be someone not in this class. I just don't want to get into potentially hurting someone else. But famous doesn't have to be everyone in the world has heard of them. Although I did have a student who wrote an introduction for Queen Elizabeth II, and another who wrote an introduction for... Okay, say Queen Elizabeth II was in the voice of C.S. Lewis. And another young man who wrote an introduction for President Obama in the voice of Jim from Huckleberry Finn. So, you know, just really kind of thinking through how can you, in a voice that shows this original author, introduce a person. The other topic that they can choose is to describe an event sometime within the past school year. So that's why you saw the basketball player. That ode was also related to this one. She chose to do that. So they get to do something that they have some interest in when they tackle this, but they're having to do it in a style of an author that really gets their writing skills improving. So the canons of rhetoric are reinforced through the script portion of this, and then they do perform it, although, as I'll mention again later, they can choose whether they read or memorize. If they read it, they have to give me evidence that they have previously read it at least 5 times so that they're not just reading it cold. They have to have practiced it at least that much, which they have no idea is a very small number of times through, but at least is a starting point to help them grasp that that's important. Then I also try to get them doing some speaking. So they're doing some writing, some speaking, because in an English class, you know, you've got language in, listening, reading, language out, writing, speaking. So we're trying to get there. In our studies of drama, I mentioned we read Hamlet. I assign parts for Hamlet. I do it by casting lots. Everybody puts their name in a hat. I draw your name out. You can turn me down once. Then your name goes back in the hat, and the second time I draw your name, you're stuck. You don't have to read more than one part. In the class size that we have, we usually need people to read more than one part. But you have that part all through the reading of the play. So you know what you're doing, you're getting into it. And everybody gets the opportunity to participate that way, but it works okay. And honestly, since Shakespeare was all played by males, I don't worry who plays what, who reads what. I just don't worry about that, because we're not actually performing it at this point. I've not chosen to make that part of this arrangement. So we read it aloud in parts. When we get to be or not to be, I think everyone should have read that speech once. So we do. But I don't read it in chorus. I tell them, all right, because invariably we get to it right before the end of a class period. Tomorrow, when you get to class, you are going to read this speech out loud for the class. What? at the same time as everyone else is doing the same thing. And if you sound like you're doing it all together, I'm going to stop you and make you start over again, because I don't want you listening to what they say. I want you listening to what you say. So it is absolute chaos. Nobody learns much of anything about it, but they've experienced the words. They can have affection for the words. And we worry later about performing it effectively, because one of the things that we do as part of recitation work is to memorize one of the major soliloquies of Hamlet. And about a third to half of them choose to be or not to be. Now, they're all different lengths, so I give them bonus credit for the long ones. And when I was still a Shakespeare geek, still in high school, my teacher had us memorize something from Shakespeare each semester, and I memorized "Oh, What a Rogue" and "Peasant, Slave, Am I," is it at Monsters with this player here, but in a fiction in a dream of passion. I can't do the whole thing anymore. It's been too long, 25 years, but I can do a lot of it with a little prompting I can get through. So I try and give them a flavor for these words are beautiful. They're worth getting into your mind along with a lot of other good, beautiful things. So they all memorize and recite one soliloquy. They can get more credit for the long one, so some of them choose the long one. I also have them each quarter memorize a poem from the time period we're studying and give a brief analysis of it. And by analysis, I define for them, I want you to use at least 5 technical poetic terms after you've recited to tell me about the structure of the poem. Tell me like what I showed you they have to find when we do things together. So they have to do that independently, but they do it orally, not written. The last thing that we're going to talk about today is actually how to make assessment grading manageable. That's one of the ways I make that manageable. I don't need for them to practice their writing skills if what I'm trying to assess is their poetic interpretation skills. Now, it may still be valuable for them to do both of those things on one assignment, but I don't always have them do both of those things. We also do a formal debate, just one in the year. They always want more, but time is time. One of the reasons it takes us 10 weeks to get through Hamlet is because we spend a little over a week preparing for and conducting a formal debate on whether Hamlet is crazy. I've done it multiple times and have had almost every possible result. Dead split. Yes, he's a loony bin. No, that man is sane. But here's how I seem, I don't know why this works, but withholding information from them seems to work. So here's one of the ways I withhold information. I don't tell them what I think. I tell them, if it's that important to you, I'll tell you after you graduate. I do occasionally have a student who comes up to me immediately following the commencement ceremony. Okay, come on, give. But I always tell them, okay, but you have to keep it quiet. Then I mentioned that we do this dramatic monologue, so I give them the opportunity, everyone delivers it spoken, but I give them the opportunity to read it from their script or to deliver it from memory. Now, even those who are reading it from their script are still acting it out. So, for example, I had a student who wrote an explanation of her shopping trip to the mall in the voice of Lydia Bennett from Pride and Prejudice, as though she were writing the letter home from Brighton. Now, I'm sorry, gentlemen, I know you don't understand Austin, but I've met one man in my entire career who loved Austin. So they do exist. I didn't marry that one. So thinking through having students give us their response to literature requires that we give them feedback, helping them grow. I think feedback needs to have 2 qualifications. It needs to be meaningful for them, and it needs to be manageable for us. Because if we can't manage it, we won't do it. And then it doesn't matter how meaningful it was. Giving them feedback the last day of class for everything in a heap doesn't work. So let's start with meaningful. If you have not yet discovered the value of rubrics, let me persuade you to the other side. I think they have some limitations. But one of the things that they do is force us to think about what's important, to set priorities. I think we overwhelm our students by trying to have them do everything every time. So if I can give them a few things to focus on, then I can work on improving those few things, and I can rotate new things into the rubric later after the class has accomplished those few things. You have a sample rubric on your handout that gives you a bit of a flavor. It takes me almost as much time to develop the rubric the first time through as it does to grade a set of papers. But it's worth doing. If you've never developed a rubric, borrow. And I know this isn't what the ed school folks tell you, but life is reality. Develop your rubric as you're grading the set of papers this year to use next year so that you're confident about what's really mattering. When I develop a rubric, I focus first on the middle column. My rubrics all have five columns, and the middle column is they meet the standard. What do they have to do to check off everything that's required? And in my class, that'll earn them a C. So you meet the standard, you got a C. You're good. Not that they think that, I know. But that's a starting point. Then the next place I go is to try and identify what does it take to really stretch to the A, because the vast majority of the students in our schools, that's what they want. I can't remember which session it was, but I heard someone mention earlier, make sure you leave yourself some breathing room where the A cannot be accomplished simply by checking a checklist. So if you look at the examples there, you'll see things that have to do with things like with excellence or in an unusually original way, things that really do allow me to say, no, you didn't get there, but you can reach next time around. This is a website, rubistar.forteachers.org, that has what it is basically a repository. People who go in and sign up for an account, and it's free. You sign up for an account, and then you create a rubric, and you can save it for others to look at. And it allows you to select a grade level or a subject area, I guess, and then kind of an assignment type. And if there are non-literature teachers in the room, you should, if nothing else, wake up from your nap and write this down now, because it also addresses things like how to grade an art project, how to grade a science lab, how to grade an oral reader's theater. So it really is a sort of widespread. And it's set up so that you'll have to do some tweaking, but you can go in and see, all right, yes, I want to think about these four categories from within writing an essay, and it'll give you about 12 to choose from, and you can pick which ones to focus on. And then someone has done the work of writing out a description of each of the levels. The number of columns in those rubrics varies, the number of rows in those rubrics varies, so as I said, you'll have to adjust it. And as a math minor, so let me give you a little bit of math lesson here. If you use a rubric where each thing has a 5-point scale, and you say, okay, you got a 3 out of 5 on that, and you meant it to be a C, you better mean that a 60% in your school will translate into a C, or you have to pad the bottom end of your rubric. So if you look at the scale on this one, you'll see that my fails to meet standards is a 6. Now, I still can say, look, you didn't even get to that level, and dock more points than that. But a student who hands in an assignment, makes a legitimate attempt, I need to make sure that they're getting some value, reward, encouragement to continue trying. So I just want you to be cautious about the math of how you set up your point system. You cannot do a direct, it's 5 points type thing. Okay. Whoops. Forward. How do I deal with making grading manageable? Well, as I said, one of the things is the the rubric. I've specified very specifically for students, what is it I expect? And I can just tell you, look, this is where you sit. I didn't have to come up with a new way to say that this time. I can give general comments, but I don't have to give comments about every one of those categories. And then I can focus their attention on just one or two things to fix. If I try and have them fix everything, I will overwhelm them. They probably won't be able to deal with that in a way that actually helps them grow. So limit your attention only to the categories on the rubric. You just have to let some things go. Also, limit the number of categories that you include. And as I mentioned earlier, you can always substitute in other ones later. So the example rubric you have is for an oral presentation. They don't do a bunch of identical oral presentations, but what they do looks a lot the same, and I can substitute in different things later on in the year. The last thing I'll say about rubrics is that those shaded areas that you see on the handout, that's my default. I assume, even though I say meets standards, I assume that most students are going to meet standards in some of those areas and have to really work to do better, but most students are going to exceed or do the best in some other areas. So just kind of thinking about that. And this is just a big picture that doesn't even cover all of what you've got that allows me to just say, I try and list the weak stuff on the left and move them to the right as they get better. So that's just kind of how things go. All right, so I've tried to give you a sense of some examples of how I instruct in literature and get to grammar, logic, and rhetoric with all those different genres. I've tried to give you some activities that the students would do in response to literature. And I've tried to tell you a little about how I go about grading and assessing. It's your chance. Do you have questions? Yes. So this is the question about this rubric is pretty comprehensive. Which rubric did I give you? Hamlet Soliloquy? Yeah. That one, because we've done so much work with Hamlet in class and they've worked through the practice of the soliloquies and recitations quite a bit, it does have most everything on it. But I would say I would still, in any given year, emphasize in my own grading and be more demanding and rigorous in a limited number of those categories, depending on what we had time to get to that year. Yes? So let me summarize your question. What do I do to have the students explain what they're doing as they do imitative writing as a means of assessing whether they really understand that? What I have them, I don't have them formally do any of that, but I tell them, I'm grading these things. You have to tell me what the original is because I'm going to look at them side by side. So my commentary back asks them those questions, but I don't ask them to explain it as a part of the original assignment. More? Yes.
I like that you're grading their
So the question is, during performance times that are evaluated, what are the other students doing so that that time is meaningful? I don't require them to do an evaluation. I do require them to be attentive and respectful. And the performances are relatively short, and these students, I think in most of your schools, are probably similarly invested in each other's lives. So I give them a little spiel about, now, you love one another, right? So show that in your attention to one another. And then I really just deal with it on a disciplinary level. If I have a violation, I don't try to grade it that way. It's a small portion of their grade that I can dock if they're not attentive or respectful, but I almost never have to use it. And I recognize that may be a blessing that I don't have to use it. Because remember, I wear that headmaster hat? So my words do have a little more gravitas. Yes. So the question is, most of what I've talked about today is on the creative side. Do I have them do any research type writing? Yes, I do. The literary analysis papers are leading toward their ability to make an argument, and then they also write a formal research paper once during the junior year. So it's part of it. It's just this. I was asked to speak about literature, so I spoke about literature. There's limited time. So, yes. Yes. So the question was, do I go over the rubrics prior to the assignment? The answer is yes. Remember I told you, if you haven't written rubrics before, write it the year before as you're grading. Once I have a rubric in place, then when they receive the description of the assignment, they receive the rubric, and that's part of my explanation with them. So they know what they must do if they want to try and achieve at a certain level. By the way, I also do, as they're working on that research paper and some other assignments along the way, part of their required assignment might be, you have to meet with me one-on-one, so I can then tackle individual aspects based on what a student's growth and needs for growth are. Yes? Do I require a first draft? Not on every assignment. So it really does vary. What are my goals? If my goal is to get them to writing imitatively, I invest time in class that they're actually doing the writing work, so I'm interacting with them along the way. But if this is, and most of them, it is their first sonnet. I mean, you know, I tell them they have to title their sonnet. 90% of the sonnet titles I get are sonnet number one. Because what did all those guys do? Sonnet number 52. So I'm not asking them to get it right the first time. I'm asking them to work and wrestle through it. But again, part of what I'm trying to do is help them see what's excellent about this writing. So they need to practice that multiple times with different people that they're imitating as well. We have time for one more question. Sure. What literature do I dive deep? Where do I do a broad overview? The course I teach is specifically focused on British literature. So we spend more time on Canterbury Tales, although not all of them. We do about four tales. We spend a chunk of time on Hamlet. We spend a chunk of time on Frankenstein. And we spend a chunk of time on Jane Eyre. I do a broader overview in some ways by going into the poetry and essays of each time period. It's a chronological sequencing for a survey class. So I try and get them an understanding of what are the trends and ideas in a time period through shorter works or occasionally excerpts. Okay. Well, it's all right with me if you want to depart or if you want to ask further questions. Thank you for your attention today.